I think the thing that was the biggest change this time is that, like, I seen a life better than using. This is what you have.
Yeah.
Like, you can make money. You have a beautiful girlfriend. Like, yep. You know, you have your dog. Like, you have all this stuff going for you. Like, this is going to be the last time.
Yeah.
You know, this stuff is here.
Yeah.
Like, if you go down this road again, like,
it's going to get taken away.
You don't
again.
Get many more opportunities.
Yeah. Right.
Opportunities
right.
are not twice as the phrase.
Yeah.
Welcome to the Fuel Hunt Show.
What's going on, Eagles? I'm Joey. Welcome to the Fuel Hunt Show. I have Drew here to the right of me, and to the left of me, I have a very special guest, Kellen Matthews, athlete, husband, father, neighborhood guy. We live in the same neighborhood. also in recovery, but we're going to get into that.
Yep.
So any opening thoughts? I was asking you for closing thoughts. I just had like for a second there, I was like, wait a second, let me ask if last Drew has any opening thoughts.
Last episode, I made a comment about wearing the same jacket, but now I notice we're wearing the same hat as one. So we'll just have to deal with it.
Yeah, we'll just deal with it. Yeah. We'll deal with it. When we make the reels, we'll just like transition.
Yeah.
We're, I'm sure Dane can probably just erase.
Yeah, Dane, Photoshop a different hat.
We'll erase. We'll
That's
video
my
edit.
Favorite quote. That yeah. you guys put out though, Condition for Chaos.
Well, we wore these for you then today, yeah. dude.
Well, that's why I did that's the good. Limited edition Condition for Chaos Chucks for him. Yes. I knew that was his motto.
Yep. So I mentioned we're neighborhood guys because we live in the same neighborhood, right? I see you often. Literally, it looks like you are running for your life.
The mile pace is insane.
It looks like he's running for his life. And I'm beeping, I'm waving. I'm like, Kellen, be waving. Dude is so locked in and I absolutely love it.
Flow
Every
state.
Time I see
He's
it.
Flow state.
I think one time I may have almost clipped him with my Jeep. Maybe almost clipped him when he's
Is it really that off? Yeah, like, you've seen him how many times?
I mean, we saw each other at the grocery store. Yeah. We see each other all the time. So, yeah. Coffee shop. We're out for a walk with your dogs. I saw you once.
Yeah, so it's funny. That's usually like the last mile. Of okay. my, you know, morning run. So
you're burning.
Yeah, fighting for my life at that point. So
how many miles is that morning run usually?
Typically it's 10 miles. Like my typical morning run is 10 miles.
That's every day.
6 days a week, I'm running at least 10 miles.
That's wild. Yeah, it's wild. But every time I see you, like, I am reminded of the energy that our community has, you know, seeing you running the streets of Philly. To me, you are pretty much a Philadelphian, but you're not from Philadelphia. You're from upstate New York.
Yep.
Right?
I forgot about that.
Well, we're going to accept you as an honorary Philadelphian, right? We're going
to
accept you.
You are proud to be a Philadelphia. Like, now you love Philly, right? I feel like
I'm absolutely have adopted the Philadelphia lifestyle. And
It suits you well, man. So let's talk about the come up, right? So you are a very familiar face in the community. Many Eagles know you. You are not just from your achievements and your accomplishments in athletics or running, but also you're here often shooting and modeling, right? So a very recognizable face in the community. But let's talk a little bit about the come up, right? So the come up is, as we talk about it on the Fuel Hunt Show, is what you've overcome to become who you are now, right? So I mentioned in the intro, kind of at the end, that you're in recovery, which I'm sure we'll touch on. Before we get there, let's go all the way back to the beginning. Upstate New York, what's it like for Kellen growing up in the town that you're from in upstate New York?
So growing up, when I was in it, I felt like it was like a completely normal way to grow up, right? Mm-hmm. Because you don't know anything different kind of coming up. I played sports. I was a wrestler. I played baseball. I was never into running or track and field.
So that was going to be my question. It was like running. So no running. Other sports, but no running.
Correct.
Okay.
Nothing endurance related at all. Just kind of like your everyday, you know, sports that you're introduced to as a kid.
Got you.
Kind of just hanging around a neighborhood. Like we were talking about, kind of out on my bike for 12 to 15 hours a day.
That was the best, wasn't
I
it?
I said earlier that you knew where your friends were just by going on the sidewalk and you would see the 20 bikes pilot.
Yeah. I never, growing up, yeah, my mom was never worried about where I was at. Yeah. I kind of just had the freedom to, you know, do as I yeah. please.
Yeah. It was different, a little bit of a different world then, you know.
Was your dad around? It was just your mom.
So my dad, getting into that, my mom and my dad cheated on his wife with my mom, got my mom pregnant. So I was, I came out of that. I was obviously like kind of the mistake, quote unquote. So there was always a weird dynamic there. My mom was essentially a single mom. So she would drop me off at his house, as like daycare.
Wow.
During the week. And that was kind of just like where I think like the anxiety and not feeling like accepted in my own skin started, because my stepmom was just not really accepting. Yeah. You know, there was always kind of just like a feeling of like, you don't belong here.
Yeah. Wow. Different. We got into it real quick. different circumstances, but I know that feeling of not belonging, being in a room full of people that smile and at you and it's normal, you know, like normal human interaction, but having that feeling deep down that you don't belong. I know that feeling really, really well, man. So that really resonates with me. I know that well. Like I said, different circumstances, but I understand exactly what you're talking about. So I can imagine then that as you continue to experience that throughout your childhood, it drove you down some paths that you didn't foresee yourself going down. That's what now I'm assuming from your question.
I was just genuinely curious, because he was talking about his mom and right. being a single mother. I was just curious if the dad, because we'll get into the story, but I believe that in a lot of these stories that we hear on the show and in the community of the few, like a lot of these individuals lack a strong father figure. And that's why, and I, like, God rest my dad's soul, but I strive to be the father to my kid I am today. And I know you and you as well. Like, we didn't have strong father figures. You had one eventually, right? Mm-hmm. But not in the beginning. And I think that's why we strive to be the dads we never had. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like, yeah. it's so important to me to raise a strong man and be the dad that I wish I had.
Yeah.
That would teach me how to swing a hammer, tie a tie. You True. Know what I mean? Like,
yep, yep.
all that important, all those important life lessons that I just never really got. So yeah. That was really just me
picking up on
yeah,
it.
Yeah, exactly.
I think we see that in each other. We do. We definitely see it in each other. So that feeling, as we're now all three of us are aware, we know the feeling really well, and we know what it can, the paths that it can drive us down. So I'm assuming that at some point in your childhood or adolescence that it took you down a path you didn't expect.
Yeah, well, I think that it was a mix of, you know, multiple things that played a role in it. I mean, my dad was also just like verbally, I don't want to say, I mean, he was borderline verbally abusive, you know, yeah. he just wasn't like super welcoming. So it got to the point where I just didn't even want to spend time,
sure.
you know, with my stepmom and my father. It was just like, yeah. I just want to stay with my mom.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Was there other kids at that house that you went to?
There was. So I have an older sister who's just older by a couple of years. So she was there. And then ironically, like my stepmom ran a daycare also. So like there was other kids that were sure. there being like sat by her mm-hmm. where it just was just like a generally unhealthy environment to be in. Sure. Like it wasn't, I wouldn't send my daughter.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
there, I wouldn't want my daughter to be in that situation.
Yeah. I think we've all learned some, we've learned some things along the way, right?
right.
That like Drew's speaking to have now been tools in our toolbox to be better fathers to our children.
One quick point to that, it's crazy. One thing I've learned later in my journey of life is how important environment is.
Mm-hmm.
Like I am so conscious of the environment that is my home and the environments that I work in and sort of the people I surround myself with that I've had to remove myself from in the past, because that kind of toxic environment, like if you look at a goldfish, it's not going to thrive in a dirty tank of water.
Yep.
So neither are we in life, right? So it was so important for me to remove myself from certain toxic situations because they were manifesting in my physical health and mental health. That mm-hmm. actually happens.
Yeah. We're at a point, like, you know, if you talk about present day, right, we're jumping around a little bit in time, but if we time travel to present day, like I said at the beginning of the show, your husband, your father, you have a beautiful wife, you have a beautiful daughter, right? You're an accomplished athlete.
Thriving.
You're doing things athletically that people literally think that they could never do, like they could never, ever accomplish. And they're seeing you do this. Now, you're very vocal about the obstacles that you've overcome and how you've transformed yourself. But I've got to imagine there's people that see ultra running Kellen and think, well, you know, must have grew up a runner, you know, had a family that supported him, always felt like he could do big things and belonged. You know, they don't know. And so much about our community and the show and the stories of the few, which you had done previously, you know, Story of the Few, is showing everyone what the come up story really mm-hmm. looks like, the overcoming mm-hmm. to become, you know.
I agree. And we can jump forward to the one thing that stood out, his tattoo on his leg. I believe you had come, is the story correct that you came across Few on and our Instagram page and that hit you so hard in your feels that you were inspired to get that tattoo? Is that how that worked?
It just spoke to me. Okay. It resonated with mm-hmm. me, like to my core. So I was like, why not throw that on the shin? You
that's,
know,
that's, yeah, on the shin.
I'll never forget. Like, I think Kyle shot you.
Yeah.
And he shot you running on the Schuylkill River Trail. And MG, at the time, she sent me the shots. And she was like, oh my God, like, you'll never believe Kellen has a Few Hunt tattoo, like, on his shin. And I'm like, no.
I thought it was coincidental. I thought you'd already, like, lived by that mantra. I didn't realize it was the inspiration behind. But you had already met MG, correct?
So I hadn't met her in person. She had like reached out through Instagram, but there was the connection through John Sullivan.
Okay.
His wife is like her sister's best friend or something like that.
All right. So then that explains it. Well, now a couple minutes in, I don't know how many minutes we are into the show. Now we realize probably why the content, the message, and the community that we created resonates so well with you, because there's pieces.
Yeah.
We all share similar pieces of our history and childhood. So let's go back to growing up. You're in sports, right? You have some challenges when it comes to family and the feelings that you're trying to process as a young man. You're in high school. What's high school look like? Still active?
Yeah, still very active, especially like early on in high school. I love to play baseball and I love to wrestle. And I started early in high school to dabble with like smoking weed a little mm-hmm. bit, drinking a little bit. At that point, it was just normal experimental stuff.
Sure.
On one end, like my father's side was chaotic. On my mom's side, especially like my extended family on my mom's side, specifically my aunts, were super loving. They had a place on the river that was like an escape for me. I would mm-hmm. do a lot of fishing there, and it was like somewhere where I could be myself. I felt safe, and everything was good. Their house was flooded at the beginning of my sophomore year. Everything was destroyed, so that escape was just like
took the haven away from you.
And while all that was going down, or right around that same time, I lost my dad, passed away, and then I also had another loss in the family. My uncle Greg passed from a liver disease. Mm-hmm. So it was just kind of just like three hits right away, on top of like just being a sophomore in high school.
Yeah, I was going to say, normal, young man, high school stuff. You know what I mean? Just, adolescent, teenage stuff. And then you're getting hit over the head with loss. Not just loss of loved ones, but loss of your haven, really, mm-hmm. right? Like, a place that you could go to be yourself, you know, that you felt you belonged in, I'm assuming.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, here, you know, in the neighborhood around here, while you were in upstate New York, in the neighborhood around here in Philly, it's the same type of thing. Kids in my neighborhood started experimenting really early, 12, you know, even before high school, with drugs and alcohol, you know, smoking weed, drinking, you know, stealing schnapps from their grandpa's freaking liquor cabinet and shit. You know what I mean? I think that I understand the picture, and I think most of the few do, because it's common nowadays. I'm assuming that the 1-2-3 combo that you were hit with maybe accelerated the experimentation a bit. Is that the...
Yeah, so after, or while really all that stuff was going down, is where it just cranked up the volume. It went from just I'll say, quote unquote, normal experimentation to daily usage. And, you know, we grew up in a time where opiates were available.
Yep.
When I came to school in the morning, it was just available. You know, there's a medicine cabinet. I could take my pick. So
and that's from, I'm assuming it's the same situation in your neck of the woods, but here, what was happening was they were available because they were prescribed to members of our family. Mm-hmm. And then one or two things were happening. Kids in school were raiding, you know, their parents' medicine cabinets, or kids in school were raiding the medicine cabinets of their friends' parents, essentially. They were getting a hold of it. There were some instances where kids in my school were breaking into homes to steal pills, essentially. But they were there. They were there here too, man. It was the beginning, or we were kind of in the throes of it, actually. But it was much, not that it's tamed now, but it was super untamed of the opioid epidemic, really, right?
I mean, everybody was they just kind of weren't aware of it.
You know? Yeah.
Everyone was just ignorant of what was happening at the time. It was a lot of over-prescription or over-prescribing. And I even had some parents that were selling us their stuff. You know what I mean? It was I have this, my one buddy growing up, his one mom specifically, single-handedly, you know, played a big role in my addiction. Not saying it's her fault, but she played a big role in the ending up
the happening. This sale of them to you guys.
Oh yeah. And it wasn't just
that's crazy.
It's wild. It wasn't hey, I have them. It was I need you to get rid of these. Here, take these.
Your school being the market.
Right.
Wow. So that's where your journey began then, I would say, right? Of addiction.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just, I didn't have any idea what I was getting myself into,
mm-hmm.
you know, at 14 years old, it was almost it sounds sick, but it was almost cool to say yo, I'm dope sick, or yo, mm-hmm. I'm having withdrawals. It was a status.
Yep. Yep.
And it was kind of, when I was in high school, it was kind of manageable early mm-hmm. on. You know, I wasn't completely off the deep end, where some of my buddies did go to treatment in high school. I will say I kind of, quote unquote, had a handle on it at that point. I really didn't. I just didn't really have the money to fuel the usage that would have sent me over the edge. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's funny how... the phrase, even you saying the phrase, I could see the calculation going on in your head of I have a handle on it. It's you know, I'm a functioning alcoholic or whatever, you know, and alcoholism runs through our family. And, you know, I've heard that term a lot. You know, I've got control of it, you know, and even for me, in my own experience, I recently stopped drinking. Crazy story is I was just going to not drink for this year, you know, and I started getting some messages once I put that message out there, and people were this is great. Like, you're never going to drink again. Like, blah, blah, blah. So I'm like, now I'm sober for life. You know what I mean? So now I'm sober for life. But even in my own experience, like, I went through a time where I was binge drinking. You know, you're like talking about 10 years ago or so, maybe even a little longer than that. Got myself into trouble, man. You know, and I always had that mindset of like, well, I'm drinking on Friday night and Saturday night, and that's it. Like, the rest of the week, I'm not drinking at all. So, like, right. I got a hold on this. Like, yeah. But what I learned through the, you know, like I said, got myself into some trouble, you know, did some classes, did some things, you know, went to some meetings. And, like, what I learned was, as soon as it starts to affect your life, like, you have a problem. Like, you no right. longer have the wheel.
No.
Bro. Like, that's the biggest thing that I took away from all of my experiences. I was like, dude, I don't have the wheel here. Like, I don't have a handle on this. The minute it affects my life negatively, there's a problem.
Exactly.
You know? So I saw that calculation in you when you started talking, and I'm like, I recognized it. You
it's
know?
Crazy that as a society, we've just accepted poisoning ourselves, and like, literally being drunk is just the effects of being poisoned mildly.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
we've
yeah.
just accepted poisoning, or like, alcohol is literal poison to our bodies, but we somehow made it, we normalized it. And if you pass out on the drinks, it's like, oh, is everything okay?
Yeah,
right. Exactly. You're not having fun anymore.
Which I feel like it's getting better as the generations move on. Like, our parents were had a completely different mindset on drinking and using than I do now. You know,
mm-hmm.
I would much rather, you know, get in the cold plunge and sauna you know,
yeah.
45 minutes to an hour. I mean,
yep.
Don't wake up hungover.
Yeah, exactly.
Know? Yeah.
You just feel amazing. Just get high on life.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's the truth. I mean, I've experienced, and this might sound woo-woo to some, but like, through meditation and meditative practices, like, you have some transcendental or high, like, high experiences, out of body experiences.
One, and I don't, Calvin, you tell me, but one thing I think that's like a stigma or like something that people don't recognize or realize is, like, when you go through an addiction, regardless of how deep the addiction is, it changes your chemistry, like, who you are, your reactions to certain situations, like, it changes your brain chemistry.
Absolutely.
And this is what you're describing, the same type of experience or changes can be experienced through positive habits as well. Like, I think that's kind of like,
no, that's exactly what I'm saying. And you can have those experiences through a lot of different modalities, right? It could be the running or the cold plunge or the sauna, pushing past that point of comfort, right? Like, sitting down for a meditation and connecting with your subconscious mind is an uncomfortable process, because you have to go through
all that other stuff,
all of the monkey mind, all that stuff that you want to think about or that's bothering you or plaguing you at the time being, and actually get to that clear meditative state.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what,
that's what you're saying. Yeah. So there's a point where you're like, you're thinking, hey, I got a handle on this. Like, you know, things are, this is normal, right? Got a handle on this. When does it change?
So after high school, I would say, I think I was like 18. So I graduated high school when I was 17. So I was probably like 19.
Mm-hmm.
And just the use of painkillers, nasally, snoring them, went out the window, and I was introduced to IV use. And I was also introduced to just like the heavier painkillers, like from the Vicodin and Percocet to like the OxyContin and Opana.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I seen like the big jump in where I was like really introduced to like that, like, addiction, like addictive behavior. Like, I was taking stuff to the pawn shop. Like, I was willing to, by any means necessary, feel better.
Yep.
You know, like, that's where it like turned into like the animalistic behavior, and shit got real.
Like the manic type.
Yeah. That's behavior. Where it got real.
When you were So that was post high school, right?
Yeah.
When you were in high school, you mentioned that some of your friends or people that you knew went into treatment. Did you lose people in high school as well?
I hadn't lost any of my close friends in high school. After high school, it started to happen really quickly.
Yeah.
Like, I can't count on my hands and toes how many like friends or like people that I was using with closely.
Yep.
Aren't here anymore.
There's got to be a part of you today that says, and you know, we'll get into, you know, maybe your, the ordeal of your hero's journey, like one specific spot that I know of your story that sticks out and how Cass played a role in getting you through that, helping you through that part of your journey. But then when you're going through that leg of the journey, were there people that helped your friends get into treatment? Did they go on their own volition? Did you at that point say like, look, like they're not like me? Like, did you think you had a handle on it and like you didn't need treatment at that time? Like, how did the treatment go in high school? Like, how did they enter?
So most of the people that went to treatment in high school was their parents. And it wasn't because these kids were like, oh, I need to go to treatment.
Yeah.
It was like the world was coming crashing down and it was like they got caught. You know, essentially it was like, hands up, you know, I'll do whatever I have to do so that my mom and dad don't hate me.
Yeah.
And in my mind at the time, I was like kind of pondering with the idea of like, I don't really know how I'm going to stop doing this because like there had been times when I was like, okay, maybe I'll just try to put these down for a couple of days and see how it goes.
Yeah.
And I would maybe last a day or two, or even there was times where I would last a week or two, but like I would always circle back to, you know, being back in the same hole and starting off right where I left off.
Yeah. I mean, I got to imagine that's the cycle. So you graduate high school, things accelerate kind of again, right? So at some point you enter treatment, right?
The first time I entered treatment, I was like, I think 20 years old.
Okay.
It was it was a detox in Buffalo, New York, Erie Hospital.
In a hospital. Okay.
Now, did something happen to get you there? Like, your mom never caught you, or did your mom just not mind enough?
I got caught up at this point. My mom, like someone had called. I had robbed somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And the person then called my mom, who was like, yo, Kellen has a bunch of rigs, which are syringes, in this spot in this room. Like, you know, my mom went upstairs, found him.
Lo and behold, right there.
When I came home, it was kind of like, you know, intervention.
Mm-hmm.
So she had no idea up until this point?
So I feel like as a mom, she knew something was going on.
Yeah.
I think she was just kind of, you know, in denial of the whole thing. And kind of just didn't want to think that, oh, my son would never do that.
Ignorance is bliss, essentially.
Exactly.
Plus, it's a different time. Like you said, there's different mindset around these things, and there was a like a lurking monster of an epidemic that was not as obvious as it is today, I think, right? Yeah. So you head into hospital treatment in the hospital, detox. What happens? I mean, do you successfully go through the detox?
The first time I went to treatment, I lasted 24 hours. I signed myself out. I was 4 hours from home.
Okay.
I signed myself out of treatment and to leave the hospital in Buffalo, New York in February. If you know anything about Buffalo,
yes, New York. In February. Yes, I do. Yeah.
So my brother lives in Buffalo. That's why I ended up going to Buffalo. He took me to the treatment center. It was like, yo, you know, I'll see you in 5 days or whatever the detox was. And,
your stepbrother.
Was
it your stepbrother?
Half brother. Same dad, different mom. So like I had got, for some reason, these people let me use the phone.
Oh.
So I'm like in the room, like call my girlfriend at the time, like, yo, you gotta come pick me up. Like, you know, I gotta
this
get out.
Was
like,
you had a lift.
This wasn't Cass.
You had a lift out.
Yeah.
You had a lift out of
so
there.
She was like, yeah, yeah, we'll be on our way. This is 4 hours away. Meanwhile, she's like using heavily too. Like, she doesn't have the means to drive to, you know, four hours. And I mean, she thought she was going to figure something out. She was never coming. Anyways, just happens that I was sitting outside waiting for them. And my brother like came back in to check on me.
Wow.
And he was like, yo, what are you doing out here, bro? And I was like, they let me out.
Oh, really?
And so I spent the rest of the time detoxing at his place, which I was successful with. I stayed clean for like 6 months. Yeah.
Wow.
At his house. Yep. And it was kind of just like my brother was doing his best to play like a father figure role at the time, which he did a great job with. He just didn't realize what he was up against. You know, like in his mind, I think he thought it was kind of just like a matter of just don't use. And I mean, that's kind of what it is. But at the same time, it runs so much deeper than that. Yeah. Like your mind is constantly fighting against you. Mm-hmm. You know, it's trying to take you back.
Yep.
Every chance it gets.
It's more of a, it's not a discipline thing. It's no. How did you're at his house, like how did he handle all the withdrawal symptoms and everything? Like did you just like power through it?
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Wow.
It was tough, but you know, after 5 to 7 days, like most of the physical stuff goes away. Like you have trouble sleeping still. Yeah. But outside of that, most of the like chills, stomach stuff, like that's out the window. So once you got over that, it was kind of just like, yo, let's get you a job. Let's get you moving. I got into the rooms of NA and I met some good people there and I kind of hung on the best I could until we made a trip back to Binghamton.
Sure. And
little did he know that as soon as I got back to Binghamton, like I was on the phone, like,
yeah,
you know.
So you got there and then the familiar air started to creep back in.
I mean, I was already having reservations before I got back to Binghamton. Like it was kind of just like the light at the end of the tunnel, sure. Which is sick to think that like that, like I was essentially, you know, I won't say cured, but I was healthy. Like everything was going good. Like I had opportunity. Mm-hmm. But the idea of getting high was still just outweighing the option to not get high.
Yeah.
You know,
it's almost like you powered through it. You saw the opportunity, but at the same time, like the full spectrum change that's required you hadn't walked that path yet.
No, you know, and I just don't think at that time that I just wasn't ready. You know, like I hadn't hit the floor the way that I needed to hit the floor yet.
Sure. There's time obviously between that detox and the moment that I know of where Cass intervened to help you complete the journey into who you are today. So there's some space in there that I don't know much about. I'm assuming that there are multiple times that you went into treatment or detoxed again, right?
Yeah. So I've been to treatment 7 times. I won't touch on them all. Specifically, I had the experience of going to Florida or like the Delray Beach area. And so if you have any idea what goes on down there, they call it like the Florida mix up. It's essentially like an insurance scam that you get pulled into. This was my 3rd time going to treatment. And yeah, I had no idea what I was walking into. My mom had no idea what she was signing me up for. It was just like my family was so desperate to get me help.
Yep.
Any other option outside of what I was doing was going to be the fix. And
I've had some friends that have went to that area, right? Or Florida generally. And like, from what I understand, I don't know much, you know, but from what I understand, there's some legit treatment that goes down there. And then there's also some like, basically it's an insurance scam, right? Is that accurate?
Yeah. So it's a lot of fraud, prostitution, you know, sales of drugs in these treatment facilities.
Yeah,
it's basically they get you down there and then they try to keep you cycling through as many times as they can, because every time you come back through that door,
they bill.
Your insurance is paying.
Yeah, they bill.
So I ended up in that cycle for a few months, and thankfully I was able to get my way out of that. I started talking to a girl. She offered me an opportunity to come to her place in Virginia.
Okay.
And I got into Suboxone maintenance.
Okay.
At the time. And that was kind of my way out of the Florida mix up. And the Suboxone maintenance, honestly, it probably saved my life, you know, for the time being.
So that's for, you know, the Eagles that are watching and listening that don't know, that's a prescribed maintenance program, right? Or yeah, prescribed maintenance where you were taking Suboxone, which quells or settles like withdrawal symptoms, basically.
So it has a blocker. The naloxone is a blocker, and then the buprenorphine, which it essentially gives you some of the satisfaction of using. It's not like quite hard as hitting as like other prescription drugs, but like helps with anxiety, calms you, like you get the feeling like you've used.
Right. So it's, and I don't want to say it's similar in any way, shape, or form, but I'm trying to draw a parallel for Eagles that may not be familiar, like almost like a nicotine patch or something like that. Exactly. Right.
It's essentially damage control.
Right.
It's
but I gotta imagine it puts space, maybe not the space you need in the long run, but it puts space between you active addiction, right? Like that, and the space you need to enter recovery successfully.
Correct. Right? It gave me an opportunity to like learn some life skills and like have a job. And like you said, create space between like the everyday ripping, running, animalistic behavior that addiction causes. And you can kind of give the perception like you're normal. That's also kind of the downfall of Suboxone also, is that you feel like I'm cured.
Yeah.
I'm good to go.
Sure. So you're in Virginia, you're on this maintenance. I'm assuming you have a job, you're working, right? You're doing some
things. Yes, I was into construction at the time.
Doing some construction. How do you find, so you went from New York to Florida to Virginia. It seems like you're making your way back to Philadelphia, right?
Yeah.
To the present day. So what happens in Virginia to bring you back here, essentially?
So really, I was offered a job up here with the same company. There was just a different opportunity up here. My employer in Virginia started to see some of my behaviors. Like I was still partying, essentially, not as hard and with the same stuff, but like he could tell like, okay, this guy can kind of get out of control.
Yep.
So he was like, listen, maybe we'll just get him away from here.
The friends that you had at the time or the relationship that you were in, they were partying too? Like this
stuff
that you were doing together?
Right. And it wasn't...
Drinking, smoking, whatever. Okay.
Yeah. So I was offered the job up here, kind of trying to change people, places, and things.
Yeah. So they were, in a way, looking out for you.
Oh, absolutely. My employer at the time did so much for me. He was like, you know, a blessing.
That's awesome, man. Because it's not something you can do alone.
Right.
You know what I mean? And to have someone in your corner like that, that's awesome. Did you at the time think you needed it, the change? Or was it something that he or she came to you, your employer, and said, hey, like, I think this is good for you at this time. Like, go do it.
It wasn't given to me like that, really. It wasn't served up to me like, yo, we're helping you out. It was kind of like, he knew what he was doing, but like I didn't really see what was going on. I was just like, okay, like a cool new job up in Philadelphia. Like they sold it to me like, yo, this is going to be great. You know, you make more money. Like here you go.
Sure.
That's crazy.
Okay. All right. So then you make your way up here. So do you stay on maintenance when you come up here?
Yeah. So that's kind of where things got a little dicey, because I was still using the same doctor I had in Virginia.
Okay.
While I was here. So every,
because here was, when you were here, it was kind of like a temporary, like you had a job, but like,
yeah,
I'm assuming you were building something. And once said thing was built, like you would go back to home base.
Right. So I was still connected to Virginia. Like I had a girlfriend in Virginia, so I would go back there once a month.
Okay.
And yeah, that was the idea. Once we finished the project that we had going here, like we'll go back to Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And after some time had passed, I realized that I wasn't going back to Virginia. And my opportunities to get back to the doctor kind of started to wither away.
Okay.
So, you know, I got the bright idea as an addict, like, like I know how to fix this.
Yeah.
You know, like,
and you probably know just the place.
Right. And I, slowly started to like go back and forth between my Suboxone and using again.
Okay. All right. So this is, so you're in Philly where you're in, you're in Philly at this time. So it's no secret, you know, where you need to go. If you're going to start to, you know, head back to your old habits and you're still on maintenance and relapsed a bit. Is this, how many times have you been through treatment up until this point? So is what, I guess what I'm asking is the next time you go into treatment, was that your last time?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So then we're coming up onto present day, right? So what happens? I'm assuming at some point during your time here, you meet Cass.
Yeah. So, I was actually in that time where I was still in between the Suboxone and using, and I went to a music festival down in Baltimore, Moonrise Music Festival, where I had met Cass previously and we connected there before. And some of my friends were going to a party that she was having at her house, you know, pregame.
Yeah.
And we connected there and we, you know, had a good time and I was able to play it off well enough. Like I was, you know, stable enough in my life where she was like, you know, we started talking again and started to reconnect.
Mm-hmm.
So I then started to make the journey back to Baltimore. You know, at first it was like every weekend I was excited to go down there. I still had my Suboxone so I could like piece together the time.
Yep.
And then as time went on, like it was getting harder and harder for me to like even leave, you know, the 2 mile radius of my house because like I need to use.
Sure.
You know, so I would start to be like, hey, I'm going to come down and then I wouldn't show. Or I would, yeah, she started to realize like something's not right.
Sure. Did she know that you were actively addicted in your past? Did she know?
Yeah, so I let her know
that you did. Like, yeah.
Listen, this is what I've had going on.
Mm-hmm.
She was just still naive to what that looked like. You know, because as an addict, like I was smart enough to let her in, but not let her in, you know, on too much.
Yep. Yeah.
And it sounds like she was kind of in a party phase too. So she wasn't maybe as concerned with to the extent of what this could be.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is where, you know, we come to the point of your story that I'm familiar with. From your stories of the field and what you've shared with us before, I assume there's some things Cass is picking up on, some things, just something's off.
Yeah.
You know, you're not showing when you say you're going to show, you know, schedule's getting a little erratic. I'm assuming that you were, some of those tendencies were starting to come back and creep in.
Quick question. So when you would say, I'm coming down to Baltimore to visit you and you wouldn't just not show up, you would just be hi and not answering her if she was reaching out to, like it was that bad.
Yeah, it got to the point where she would like, she would have my location on her phone and like there's a few times where she like came to find me.
Wow.
You know, and I was like in a motel somewhere in like halfway in between Philly and Baltimore where I just like thought it was a good idea to like, you know, score some crack on my way there, like, oh, I'll just get some crack and drive down to Baltimore, you know, and then we'll hang out when we're there with, like I would, you know, get off track halfway through and end up in a motel somewhere.
Two things. It's crazy how disoriented you are. Like the count of today would never think that was a good idea. And also second, kudos to Cass for literally seeing that on the phone, and then like, because you're not her husband at that point, you're just a guy she's dating. So it shows you that she must have really loved you, and obviously to this day does, that she literally would get in the car and go find you.
Absolutely.
So these are some pieces of your story and your story together with Cass that I didn't know.
Right.
You know, I know of the moment, you know, and we'll talk about that, where, you know, she called you, but I did not know that, you know, she was by your side like this way before that moment.
Oh yeah. Cass had been like, I'd put Cass through it. Yeah. You know, like, although she wasn't there with me, like she wasn't like living with me at the time, like she was still getting like the residual effects of, you know, loving someone who is suffering with the disease of addiction 100%.
Yeah. Yeah. And in some ways, the not knowing, you know, like she knows that you're suffering, you're in pain and you're struggling with the disease, but you're using and some of that animalistic behavior, like she doesn't know where you are and what you're doing. She just knows that you're not there with her.
Right.
You're in two different geographical locations, you know?
It is a testament to everything we preach at Fuel Hunt. It's like on the other side of that pain and what seems like a never ending struggle is so much happiness and power. Because if you look at the life you guys are living today, I mean, just from a friend and a bystander, you guys are like, have a beautiful family, like amazing energy. Like I always say, Kellen is one of the few people I've met that can truly brighten a room just by walking in it. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And you feel it when he's there. Uh-huh. And I've told you that. And
yeah,
it kudos to her for sticking through it. And like, she's living the fruits of the labor of being like, I'm going to believe in this kid or
this guy. I mean, not many people.
No.
I mean, not even like my family, mm-hmm. you know, like people that are supposed to stick through that, you know, like stuck by me. Yeah. Like everybody wrote me off.
I feel it's often the people that you don't expect, you know, that are going to weather that storm with you. I mean, you both, Drew says, you know, kudos to you both. Like you both had to pass through the gates of hell to get to where you are right now, you know, you especially. So, you know, much respect.
And you'll get the beautiful family that you have now not by going through some things.
much respect to you, man, for not only doing that and coming out alive on the other side, but having the courage and the bravery to sit here today and tell this story. I knew that we were going to get into some things today. I didn't think we were going to get into them as soon as early on, but we were going to get into some things. And wow. And like, I know that every member of the community, regardless of what their struggle or addiction is at the moment, can see hope in you and can see light in you. And I think that's the light we see when you step into the room and you light it up. You know, that's you've passed through all of that darkness, literally like the gates of hell, I would assume. If that's not an accurate depiction or metaphor, you tell me, but like, To be able to shine the way you do today, man, you had to really pass through some darkness. And I had no idea Cass was there she was there for much more of it than I was aware. So, you know, now you're going through it, right? Like the animals coming back, right? And we'll get into maybe towards the end of the show, come tie this up in a little bit, but the animal never leaves, I would assume. You know, it's always there and it's something that you have to be acutely aware of, that the animal's always there. The addiction is always there, you know, it's something you have to constantly keep at bay, but she's helping you, right? In this situation where the animal's coming back and it reaches a tipping point where it seems as though you feel as you have no more hope or no other options.
Right. I had just been through it so many times at this point. Mm-hmm. Like the up and down of like everyone around you, like letting them down.
Yeah.
You know, like I had enough of telling my mom, like, yo, I'm using again. Like I had enough of letting everybody know that, yo, I fucked up. Like, like the shame and the guilt that comes along with making the mistake of picking up again is just, it's like gut wrenching. I have dreams to this day of like that feeling of like,
yeah,
like the panic and the anxiety of like, I fucked up. Like in the dream, like I have no idea how I got there. It's just like,
you're there.
Right.
That's what I mean. Like you, social media is a great tool and it's a great thing. It brought us together, right? Mm-hmm. Today, here. But it's also in some ways a highlight reel, right? And bro, you got a great smile, got great energy. You do great things. You got a beautiful family and people see that on social. And I bet they think that you don't have those types of dreams anymore, that type of panic, like you don't feel it anymore, but you've confirmed for them that you do, you know, and that's kind of what I was trying to get at when I explained the animal, like it's always there. And I feel like you're just like, there's probably some days where you just have to pitchfork it. Like, you know, you have a dream, you wake up and you're like, you know, fuck, like, you know, and just subdue it really. So you get to a point where you were no longer able to say the words, you know, I'm using again, or what you feel as though this is like rock bottom, I'm assuming. You're in Baltimore at the time, right?
Yeah.
Driving back.
Yeah, I'd made the trip down to Baltimore.
Yeah.
It was actually one of those weekends where I told Cass I would be there at a certain time. And like I had got, you know, off the
sidetrack.
Yeah, I'd got sidetracked exactly. And I spent like my entire paycheck, which I needed to like, you know, have per day so that I could go to work and kind of function.
You have a life, dude. You have right. a job, you yeah, have a place you're living. You're like, you have like,
yeah, yeah, I had yeah. some things going on. Yeah, right. Yeah. So like, things just went sideways. And,
is this assault? Like when you're making these trips, you're getting, I know sidetrack's a really soft word to use, but when you're getting sidetracked, right. And you're letting the animal take the wheel, right? That animalistic behavior. Like, are you doing that? Are these solo missions or do you have?
Yeah, they're solo missions. Well, so I had a buddy that I was living with at the time, but I would go to Baltimore on my own.
Okay.
And like oftentimes when I got away from my homie Potter at the time, the decisions I made got a lot worse.
Yeah.
That's a long drive too, just to be sitting there thinking.
Bro, and your thoughts, like, and listening to music that you listened to before that could be a trigger, and exactly. passing through hot zones. And I know it's 2 miles from me if I get off this exit. Exactly. Like, bro, like, you know, I haven't been there, but I've had friends that have been, and I get it. Like, from the stories and the things that they've told me and the behaviors that I've seen them exhibit over the years, I understand.
I think we kind of cut him off in the story though.
Yeah, so you're coming, you're coming back. You're
yeah, so I was using a lot at the time. So I blew like $1,500, $1,800. And so like that shame and guilt set in, the anxiety starts to set in. And I had already been having thoughts of like suicide because like I seen like my options starting to run out. I'd burned so many bridges and like I could see my fate coming. Like I knew it was either going to be the old saying, either jail, institution, like rehab or death. Yeah. You know, and I just didn't feel like I had it in me to do the other two. Like I wasn't like built to go to jail. Looking at the mountain of recovery at the time, like I just couldn't conceive like living without getting high at the time, because like I mean it's really the only thing I had known, you know, for the last 12 years of my life is just using. So I had like had that bad weekend. I was at Cass's house. I remember we were watching a Packers Cowboys playoff game, and we went out to eat and she was like, dude, what's going on with you? Like, what's going on? I was just brushing her off. Nothing. I was kind of just quiet. We ate and I was like, all right, you know, I'm going to get going now. It was like late on a Sunday night and I had to work the next morning. So I was like, all right, I'm going to get out of here. Just that entire time thinking when I get to the bridge over 95 that crosses the Susquehanna River, I was just going to pull my truck over and then jump off. And like, I got my car, I was headed back home, just kind of like having that anxiety of like thinking about doing it, but kind of at the same time being like relieved that like, you know, all this stuff was going to come to an end. And Cass called me and was like, just to reiterate again, like, yo, dude, what's going on? And
like, she didn't let go.
Right.
Like, you know what I mean? She
didn't believe you.
Right.
Yeah. She didn't let go.
So when she asked that the final time, I just kind of like broke down, you know, and was like, yo, this is what's going on. Like, I don't feel like I can tell anybody else. Like, I don't know what to do. Like, this is the mountain that I'm up against right now.
Yeah. So she was coming to you, like, she wanted to help. Like, she didn't come to you. It's not like she gave you an ultimatum when you were watching the game. Like, hey, tell me what's going on or else, or like, this is over. Or she like repeatedly just kept coming to you. Like, look, like, my instincts tell me something's wrong and I want to help.
Right.
And that's what she did again when she made that call, thankfully, before you pulled your truck over.
Right.
So did you go to treatment right away after that?
So it got a little dicey there for a bit because I didn't have insurance at the time. And with like the whole insurance and treatment deal going on in the United States, like, it gets really complicated getting into a bed. You know, it's not something where you can just be like, okay, I'm ready to go to rehab now. Like, I'm ready to get better. And they just like let you in the door.
Yep.
It was about another month. I had come clean to everybody at this point, which was a huge relief.
Yeah.
By the way, like, that was a huge weight lifted off my shoulders. Like, yo, this is what I got going on. I'm willing to go to treatment. So like, let's make a plan. Let's make this happen.
Yep.
So that's what we did. We started to chip away at it. My bosses at the time were like kind of giving me an allowance per day.
Okay.
Essentially, because like, I needed to go to work. Like, I needed to make money. And like, I was using like 45 bags of dope a day at this point. So I was shooting a bundle of dope at a time.
Yeah.
Which, like, for reference, like, I've lost a lot of friends to a single
bag of dope. Yes.
So like, I was using heavily at the time.
Bro, the fact that you're even here, the fact that you lived through that.
Right.
Is crazy.
Why? So during a work day, how would that go off?
It would depend. Usually in the morning I'd use like two or three bags, you know, just kind of push off. I'd be able to go to work, get done what I needed to do, a couple bags in like throughout the day. Like, I'd take a break, use, you know, and I was doing apartment renovations at the time. So it's not like I had someone that was like overwatching me. Like, I was responsible for, you know, renovating two apartments. I had a guy working for me. So we were basically, you know, on our own.
The freedom.
And you were a good would they say you were a good employee at the time?
Well, I would work hard. Like, I have that, like, this heart. Like,
no
matter if I'm using or not, like, I just have, like, that hard work. If you give me a task to do, like, I'm going to hit it
that's
hard.
That's wild to think, though. Like, that's
So I'm assuming when you went in then to treatment for the last time, you had that same work ethic when you went in. And at this point, you were like, look, that's it. Like, I'm doing whatever it takes.
Yeah, so being that I had gone to treatment so many different times, for whatever reason, when I got to this treatment facility, I just had like a different perspective on being there. Like, typically I would show up and I would be like the asshole that was there, like talking during class. Like, I say class, it's like, you know, you go through like some classes while you're there. I was just not following the rules. Like, I was still just being like rebellious. I was acting like a kid, a child.
Yeah.
And when I got to this place, I just decided that I wasn't going to be like that. I was just kind of going to do what they told me to do. And I ended up being more of like a role model while I was there. Like, you know, I started like reading the Alcoholics Anonymous book. I started to like actually write in a journal and write the things that they're asking me to do. And like, calling people, apologizing to people, trying to make positive steps in a positive direction.
Yep.
Instead of like trying to hook up with girls or like trying to sneak cigarettes or, you know, just doing the dumb shit. So yeah, it was 60 days, which had been the longest time that I'd spent like in a treatment facility. And when I got back when I got out, I made the choice on my own to go to a sober living. Like Cass was like, yo, you could just come move in with me. Like I have a place in South Philly. Like,
yeah,
we just live together. Like I was like, no, you know, like I should.
Yeah, you're committed, dude.
Yeah. I should take all the steps necessary. Yep. So.
Yeah, you were committed.
Yeah. I went to a halfway house in Norristown on Cherry Street. This old guy, Bob.
Like, in where?
Norristown. On Cherry Street. Yeah. I don't know if you know that area. It's not really great. Like, one of my drug dealers lived around the corner.
Yeah, like, Norristown now.
Which
yeah.
was, like, old me, I would have relapsed day one.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
like.
You flipped. Dude, talk about a test. Like, another, like, just another test. You know what I mean?
You flipped the switch this time, though. It sounds like you were there was yeah, no that going was back.
Exactly yeah. it. And I think the thing that was the biggest change this time is that like I seen a life better than using. Like the guys I was working for at the time were like, "Yo, like you still have a job,
mm-hmm.
like this is what you have.
Yeah,
like you can make money. You have a beautiful girlfriend. Like, yep." You know, you have your dog, like you have all this stuff going for you. Like this is going to be the last time.
Yeah.
You know, this stuff is here.
Yeah.
Like if you go down this road again, like.
It's going to get taken away.
You don't get many more opportunities. Yeah.
Right.
Opportunity is not twice is the phrase. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it seems as though I'm sure that transition into the beauty was difficult, but you did it. And it seems like to me, from again, like Drew said, a friend and a bystander, that the beauty is multiplying. Like you started, you self-described as a role model when you were in treatment. You decided to do things differently and become a role model. And I think, I know that reputation of role model has continued and multiplied. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? To this moment, even that we're sitting here, you having the courage to tell your story, which again, I appreciate, I have gratitude because there's people in our community that need to hear this. And I know it's not easy for you. I'm sure you've done it before, but I can feel that it's still not easy. So the utmost gratitude and respect, man.
I appreciate that.
For who you've become. What a come up story. We've talked a lot about a lot of overcoming and becoming. Let's bring it to the present. And husband, right? Father, right?
Savage.
Savage athlete, ultra runner, right? All of the things. Let's just talk about two of the things. And while we bring this in for a little bit of a landing, your role as a father, very difficult. We're all fathers here, right? Is the most important and difficult role that I believe a man plays, you know, in his life. Also, there's some other difficult stuff you do. Marathon running, ultra running. When you dig deep in both of those areas of your life now, when it gets hard and you have to dig deep, whether it's the 60th mile that you're running or whether it's a, you know, 2 a.m. feeding or whatever it is, you know, when your daughter was younger, when you dig deep to get through those moments, do you dig deep into your past? When you were in active addiction, where do you go?
I mean, that's exactly where I go. Like, yeah. This stuff is easy. Right? Like,
yeah.
It's not even, you know, it's not even comparison to my past. So like waking up with the baby at 2 a.m. or, you know, running 100 miles, like that stuff stops.
Yeah.
You know, like it ends immediately.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, you just go back to sleep after feeding, or you stop running for a minute and like the pain starts to subside.
Yeah.
But like when you're in active addiction, bro, like there's no escaping it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's well said.
Yeah.
I attest that to the quick short story with Parker. We almost lost him when he was 7 months old to croup. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but we were in the hospital for like 2 weeks and they were fighting to keep him alive at different times during the process because he would get the viral infection would take over his lungs. But going through that made every other trip to the ER and every other seemingly small spill It's so easy. And I attest, I make that comparison to life. Like, the harder the thing you go through, the easier it makes everything else.
You know, I've expressed my gratitude, man. I've expressed, you know, the respect I have for your courage and your bravery to share your story. I think one thing that we probably haven't expressed yet, maybe we did, we've covered a lot, man. And like, I've been on a little bit of a silent emotional roller coaster as you've told your story. So I may have forgotten some things that I've said, so I apologize. But how honored we are that you have chosen to represent Fuel Hunt and like what we're doing, man. And you don't just... You didn't just find us and like say like, yes, that's me. Like, I'm just going to live this. Like, you've completely transformed yourself and you've said in not so many words, like, hey guys, like what you're doing resonates and people need to hear this. And I believe in you and what you're doing so much so that I'm going to tattoo it on my shin. Yeah. So like, we are very honored that a person of your caliber, a role model of your caliber, has chosen us on your journey. So thank you.
I do have one question, Kellen. I'd like to ask people that have overcome challenges or achieved great things, for members of the Fuel Hunt community that are maybe struggling with addiction or just going through a hard time in life, not necessarily even addiction related, but like, what advice do you have for them to keep going?
I mean, it would just be to not give up. Like, I mean, at the end of the day, I know that's so cliche to say, but like, as long as you don't stop, like, you always have the opportunity to make it through, you know, whatever you're going through. It's just like taking that one step, and then that one step turns into, you know, a lifetime of accomplishments, essentially. If you let it take you to where you need to go.
If you've been listening to the show the past couple episodes, one continuing theme that Drew and I say is, it sounds so cliche until it's not.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think it's also a beautiful metaphor in the advice you gave, like putting one foot in front of another, like taking that step, because you take one step and then you take another and another. And then before you know it, you're running an ultra marathon. And you have so much distance between who you were and who you are today, you know, and we didn't even touch on some of the crazy running and athleticism and all the stuff you're doing, but that stuff is very prevalent on your feed and your presence on social media. So why don't you tell everybody what your current hard thing is, your current challenge that you're pursuing, and then where they can find you. And please do mention Recovery Run Club as well.
Okay. So my goal for 2024 is to run one marathon or further each month while bringing awareness to the disease of addiction. So I've completed three of those marathons so far. I did Houston. I've done Houston. I did a 50K in North Jersey last month, and I'm getting ready to do Two Rivers Marathon in not this weekend, but the following weekend.
Nice.
So, that's my goal. Do a lot of running and doing a lot of hard stuff. And I just released a run club local to Philadelphia for now called Recovery Run Club. And it's for anybody who is in recovery in any capacity. You could be from eating disorders, you know, domestic violence, addiction. I mean, you could just be advocating for someone who is in recovery, or you've been affected by any of these diseases. Mm-hmm. We welcome you to come out and kind of join the community and get after it. And hopefully this turns into something bigger than just, you know, once a month.
I know that it absolutely will. You had a great turnout at the first one. I missed the first one. It was the original date postponed because of the weather, right? Yeah, and rescheduled. It's so
raining up.
I missed it. But I'm looking forward to joining you. Like you said, all faces, all paces. I'm glad it's all paces because I'm slow.
How far do you run on the run club?
So the last time we did a 5K, which is just 3 miles, we did the Ben Franklin Bridge. So we started one side, ran to one side, ran back. The views are great, you know.
Yeah, good vibes, dude. Yeah, good energy.
I feel like once you get running with a group of people anyways, like you start talking to somebody, you start running a lot faster than you, than you actually think.
This is true. Same thing with the Few Fest, man. Like, you know, a 17-mile ruck plus loaded carry.
Let's go.
People were like, you know, even me to a certain extent, I was like, we're going to make this super hard. Like, we're just like spur of the moment, day of. And then I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, wow, like we did make this a little harder than I intended. But it's so true. Like when you're doing it together with people, it's so rewarding and you feed off each other's energy that the pace improves and just feels great. And so I'm really excited for everything you got going on. I'm going to join you at the next one. Who knows? Maybe I'll run like an 8-minute mile. Surprise myself. No, I won't.
We'll get you at an 8-minute mile. Come out.
maybe I'll show up with some heavy things to carry.
Running shoes though. No, I
got some trail. I have some trail runners. So
this dude's wearing the toe shoes.
Yeah.
I mean, some people do the toe shoes.
Don't be that guy.
Yeah. Look, he supports it. I'm in. All right. So I'm gonna join you at the next one. And I really hope maybe we'll do some cross collaboration and like some of the gang from Recovery Run Club can join us at the Few Fest too.
Absolutely.
We'll do some rocking.
The Few Fest it might be a little too slow pace for, yeah, he might want to run the.
He might run it with the rock.
He might be ahead of you.
Yeah, I just need a heavier ruck.
Yeah, there you go.
Very heavy ruck.
All right, man. This was great. We're going to bring it in for a landing. Thank you so much, man. Thank you so much.
Tell them where to find you. I didn't know.
Oh, yes. Where to find you.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Thank you. TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, Kellen Runs Philly. Yeah, I'll be there.
All right. And I'm looking forward to seeing you in the neighborhood, man. Just running for your life, man. Yeah, just running for your life. I love it. All right. I'm going to leave the Eagles with a sign off that they know by this time. They know. Mm-hmm. Right? They could probably repeat it themselves, but it's worth repeating.
I agree.
Always choose hard work over handouts. Always choose effort over entitlement. Remember, no one owns you. No one owes you. You're one of the few. Let's hunt.